This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is Dan Gordon. Dan is a former administrator for Federal Procurement Policy, OFPP, OMB, all those acronyms. He also served a lot of time at the Government Accountability Office, heading up the bid protest group. And now Dan, unfortunately, has left government service and is actually the Associate Dean for Government Procurement Law at George Washington University School of Law. Dan, welcome to the show.
Roger, thank you. I'm delighted to be here again.
Well, it's great to have you back. And I think first I'd just like to ask you, so how's the transition been and what are you up to these days in your new job? You're a faculty member.
The short answer is that I'm having fun. Although I have to tell you, retiring from the federal government after 20 terrific years, 17 years at GAO, a year of a clerkship before that, and then 2 years in the Office of Management and Budget, it's tough. I worked with wonderful people at each one of those institutions, and it's tough saying goodbye to them. But fortunately, we are actually physically very close. GAO isn't that far from the White House complex, and GW Law School is very close to the White House complex.
You're kind of close to GSA there, too, aren't you? Or you don't want to say that, do you? Too loud, right?
Not far away at all.
Yeah. So what are you up to? What's what is your new role exactly, and what are you doing? What's your responsibilities?
It's a combination, Roger, of doing things that are very different and doing things that are very similar. The great thing is I'm still in government procurement law, so that part of my natural rhythm of work is talking to people, whether it's at the agencies, the contracting agencies, or OMB, or the law firms, or other people that are involved in the business, the contractors themselves. So there's a lot of continuity from my point of view. But I'm now at an educational institution, and I get to share in the excitement that we're feeling right now as a new semester has just gotten underway and a new school year of training the next generation of procurement lawyers. And I got to tell you, it's just a pleasure working with those students.
Well, GW Law School is, as far as I know, maybe you could tell me who your competition is, but it's the one school that has a nationally recognized government contracts program for its law students. And, you know, I've actually gone over and, before your time, I went over and didn't lecture, but presented before one of the classes. Now, folks, it's a great place in the sense there's a lot of full-time students, but there are also part-time students, folks who work in government, for example.
Absolutely. We have, for example, lots of Air Force, Army JAGs that are full-time military, and the military is paying for their education for them to come and get an LLM degree. We have lots of people that are working full-time, people that are working part-time, people that are in the market for work. So it's a very nice mix in that sense.
Yeah, and it is recognized as, obviously as a school, it's recognized as a thought leader with your faculty, Steve Schooner, yourself, in terms of government procurement and thoughts on that. And so today we're going to talk a lot about, your observations regarding our procurement system, where things are going, some key issues. But I did want to ask you about one thing. My understanding is that GW has started a new Master's of Science for Government Contracts program. That's a business school. Is that in partnership with the law school?
It's actually interdisciplinary. So the degree is technically awarded by the business school for all sorts of reasons, but it is very much a joint effort of the business school and the law school. Essentially, half the curriculum is business courses. Half of the curriculum is our government procurement law courses, so that the students are going to get the benefit of studying with people like Professor Chris Eukins and Professor Steve Schooner when he's back. He's on a sabbatical this year from teaching, and me and my other colleagues. Neil Couture is the director for that program, and many of your listeners know Neil because he was the head of NCMA, the National Contract Management Association, for a good number of years. So these students are going to come in. It is aimed at people who are, for the most part, not lawyers, but they need to know enough about government procurement law so that they can excel in their companies and in their agencies.
It sounds like it's a great idea, I think, in just terms of what, you know, the procurement community as a whole, the, you know, training the next generation of the workforce, whether it's people going to the private sector, like you mentioned, or going into government.
Absolutely.
It's a great addition, I think, to the overall.
Neil Couture led a market research for us early this year, and we discovered that there is significant demand for an academic degree for non-lawyers who are rising executives in their agencies and in their companies to know about government procurement law combined with business.
Right. And hopefully I'll get to come talk to some folks who are taking those courses down the road.
We'd love to have you.
Okay. But hey, now let's turn to some of the key issues of the day and what's going on from your perspective in government procurement. And I know one of the areas that we talked before the show that you were interested in providing some insight and thoughts on and just having a conversation about is the area of low price, technically acceptable award evaluation criteria. That and sort of the idea of award and initial proposals. And there's a big trend. I mean, you hear it every day in the market that, you know, there's a growing, reliance on or use of low price, technically acceptable offers, awards for their evaluation criteria. And I'd just like to get your thoughts on it to start the conversation.
With great pleasure. I'll tell you, Roger, I've spent a lot of time thinking about it. There are obviously situations where low price, technically acceptable, is really the right way to go. When you know exactly what you want and you don't want more than the minimum and you can define the minimum very clearly, which is especially likely to be the case when you're dealing with commodity goods, LPTA, as they call it, low price, technically acceptable, may be the right way to go. I keep hearing stories, both from industry, but also sometimes from agency people, that agencies are using low price, technically acceptable, not because they think it's the best approach, but because they think it's easy, they think it protects them from extra work, and in particular, because they think it protects them from bid protests. All of those are bad reasons to use low price, technically acceptable. One of the interesting things, I'll tell you, some of your listeners know that at GW.
They're my readers too.
They are
I write a blog.
An excellent point. Your listeners and your readers, some of them know that we teach international and comparative public procurement law. And through that, through the teaching of that course, which I did this past spring, one of the things that I got very focused on is that in many countries, you always use low price, technically acceptable. You don't have the option of doing a best value trade-off the way we can in the United States system. And I think it is just a crying shame, let's say, to give up on that extra tool that we have, the ability to do a trade-off and say, you know what, in this case, I'm willing to pay extra for better past performance, or I'm willing to pay extra for a stronger staffing proposal. I don't know whether it's true that there's been a significant increase in the use of a low price, technically acceptable. I haven't seen data, and I'm afraid I'm a GAO or in my DNA. I like to see data. But if it's true that there's been an increase, boy, it's worth pressing, because I think it's unfortunate, for example, if our contracting officers think that low price, technically acceptable protects them from a bid protest, they're just wrong.
Right.
If that's what someone thinks, it's just not true.
Right. It just moves the, you know, the issue identification for potential protest to other areas. Wait, did they meet the spec?
Absolutely.
And those type of things, right? And if it's a big enough dollar procurement, yeah, there's more incentive.
There's going to be a protest.
Yeah.
If you're talking about a $5 billion procurement, you're going to have a protest more likely than not. And if it's a run-of-the-mill procurement, people forget more than 99% of our procurements go through without a protest.
Right.
Protests are relatively rare unless you're talking about a big dollar procurement.
Well, so to me, you know, it boils from what you've said, you know, the reasons you were hearing anecdotally why people are utilizing low cost, but it really gets back to making good business decisions, right? And what's the outcome you're trying to achieve by that procurement? Not that it's an easier way to award, it's less messy, I don't have to do a trade-off analysis, that kind of thing. You really, to me, it gets back to looking at what the outcome is you're trying to achieve for that particular procurement.
Absolutely. And that's why the other point you mentioned is such a good companion case study, and that is making award based on initial proposals. When the government does that, when the government could hold discussions but doesn't hold discussions because, in particular, because they're afraid of a bid protest, it's so frustrating for me, because the government is probably leaving money on the table. The government may be walking away from a proposal, which is actually the best proposal. There's some relatively minor problem with it or something the government's not comfortable with. One round of discussions might get us better prices, better proposals, and the idea that we're protecting ourselves or think we're protecting ourselves by making award based on initial proposals, I've heard it for more than 10 years. We need to get over it and say, folks, we have the ability to conduct discussions. It's a tool. We should be using it whenever it makes sense.
Yeah. And Dan, you know, speaking of discussions, we have to have a little discussion of advertising. So we do have to take a break. But when we come back, we'll be talking more with Dan Gordon. Dan is the Associate Dean for Government Procurement Law at George Washington University School of Law. And we'll talk a bit more about award on initial proposals, talk a little bit about GAO versus Court of Claims. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Dan Gordon. Dan is currently the Associate Dean for Government Procurement Law at George Washington University School of Law, former Administrator of Federal Procurement Policy at the Office of Federal Procurement Policy in the Office of Management and Budget. I had to say that once, Dan. I had to do that once. Okay. And I promise I won't do it again. Yeah, that's more for the listeners in terms of all those names and names. But when we took the break, we could talk a little bit more about award initial proposals. But I think, you know, I think we covered that pretty well. And I agree with you that, you know, failing to have discussions, there's always an opportunity for government, in my view, to get a better deal, leaving money on the table, potentially better solutions if you address some uncertainties in the proposal, let's say. And I think that's sound advice that, you know, whenever possible you should, and the government has a capability to do it. They need to have confidence in the system and in themselves. But another area speaking of issues and creating challenges for government, bid protests. There's no better person to talk about bid protests given your career at the Government Accountability Office and the role you played there, very constructive role. So can you just talk about just general trends first? Like, you know, you hear, you know, the last couple of years, you hear this, oh, protests are exploding. Oh, there's the issue with protests on multi-board IDIQ contract task orders over $10 million. Now, all those issues and, you know, the sky is falling. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the current trends and stats?
Absolutely. One first point that I always think people need to be reminded of, Roger, is that protests are relatively rare. Frank Kam from RAND and his colleagues did a very interesting study recently looking at Air Force procurements, and they found that the percentage of Air Force procurements that get protested has dropped over time, and that it is now something on the order of 0.5%. That is to say, 99.5% of contract awards in the Air Force are not being protested. I've looked at other agencies, and I think the figures are similar. So you're talking about a rare event. As I said before the break, it is true that when you're talking about a large dollar procurement, obviously protests are far more likely. But it is not true that protests are common. Not only that, when GAO sustains protest or the Court of Federal Claims rules in favor of a protester, that itself is relatively rare. Incidentally, the Court of Federal Claims and GAO, people have commented to me recently and said, Dan, don't you think there's a problem that the court is disagreeing with GAO? My answer is, I don't think there's a problem. I think we're in a really healthy situation where the Court of Federal Claims has a well-established reputation. It has judges that are strong and knowledgeable about the procurement system, issuing well-reasoned decisions. And you have GAO, where you have a core of some 30 or so attorneys who are also cranking out decisions that are well-reasoned, well-written. I think we've got a system that works well. People say to me, isn't it terrible that the court can look at a case after GAO looks at it? I say, I don't think it's terrible at all. First of all, it's not that many cases. It's not that many cases. The court overall has fewer than 100 cases a year, and only a fraction of those are cases that were at GAO first. And secondly, I don't think it's unhealthy to have a judge available as a double check when the party is very dissatisfied at GAO. It feels to me like we have a system that works well, relatively efficiently. The court makes the decisions come out quickly, even though they're not required to by law, the way GAO has a deadline. The court doesn't have a statutory deadline, and yet it gets those bid protest decisions out quickly. I think the system works surprisingly smoothly and without the delays and the disruptions that are often attributed to it.
Well, do you think folks are saying that, raising that issue of a disagreements between GAO versus the Court of Federal Claims with a view towards, navigating the procurement process, and now you've got GAO that's been saying one thing over here, and I relied on that. Like, if I'm a government attorney, I'll look at that and say, okay, we have this situation in our procurement. I'm looked at all the case law, GAO, and it indicates that, here's the best way we can handle this issue versus, now the court, to some is, issued some decisions that have been pretty inconsistent with, or essentially, for lack of a better term, and I'm using layman's terms, I'm not putting on my lawyer hat right now. So essentially sort of overturned GAO's decision and the reasoning behind it, and that creates some uncertainty. Is that what the concern is?
I've heard the concern, and I certainly would agree that if you work at a contracting agency and you feel that you've been whipsawed because GAO sustained the protest, recommend that you take a course of action, and then the same matter ends up at the court and the court comes out the other way, are you going to feel whipsawed? Sure. The real question, though, isn't does that ever happen? The question is, how often does it happen? In my opinion, if that happens a couple times a year, it wouldn't be a disaster, and in fact is rarer than that. Even when the court disagrees with GAO, as it did in the Turner Construction case, GAO found there was an organizational conflict of interest. Both the Court of Federal Claims and the Federal Circuit felt there was not one. It strikes me, and I've gone over the decisions pretty carefully, as an area where there is nothing unhealthy with the court coming to a different conclusion from GAO. I thought it was a healthy reminder for everybody that you shouldn't race to say there's an organizational conflict of interest unless there really are hard facts pointing to a conflict.
Right. I agree with you on that. On bid protests, you are the author of the Mythbusters policy. You know that's one of my favorite things.
And that's no myth.
That's right. That is no myth. And it seems to me that the importance of communication in the procurement process, not only, the memo did focus a lot on in the requirements development phase, and engaging industry in terms of trying to figure out the best way to proceed with a requirement and how to solve the problem. But is there other benefits? The more you communicate, the clearer the understanding, and I go right through the procurement process to the debriefing, the more a losing vendor, let's say, who has a better idea why they lost, how the thing was structured, there's a element of trust in that that's developed through that communication. Is that, was that one of your thoughts when you were
Absolutely.
Putting that together?
I viewed, and more importantly, we, because it was really a team effort, we viewed communication as a win-win. The government benefits from that communication every bit as much as industry benefits from it. It wasn't meant to be something to help industry or, for that matter, just help the government. It was meant to help both sides. When people resist communication, it tends to be on the government side. I recognize that. It's partly because our acquisition workforce is overworked. They're worried that the communication is going to be a waste of time. They don't want to just be subjected to marketing efforts by vendors. I appreciate that. But they're also afraid of getting into legal trouble. They're worried that someone's going to accuse them of having a conflict of interest or otherwise something protestable is going to happen. So what I always told people in the agencies is, sure, you should work with your lawyers. You need to be sure that agency counsel is comfortable with the communication. But when I met with agency procurement lawyers, what I heard from them was, yes, we can communicate more. We're in favor of more communication. We all benefit from more communication.
Right. And I can tell you both on when I was in government as a procurement counsel and then and during my time at Mayor Brown, I saw more situations that may not have mitigated the protest, but I think it might have mitigated some of the issues that are raised because, you know, on the big procurements, as you know, there's multiple issues that are thrown on the table in a potential looking for a potential, you know, the strategy is we got to identify, they got to be credible issues, but multiple issues. And there are always areas where there may have been some miscommunication or lack of communication. So there's a misunderstanding on the part of the losing vendor as to why that part of the proposal was or was not an issue. And just being able to mitigate that, it seems to me, beyond the overall process and the idea of having good requirements, it's such a positive aspect of the system. I wish everybody was using your memo.
I will tell you that again, in other systems and other countries, you're not allowed to have that communication. Our system allows more communication, and in many cases, it requires more communication. For example, you mentioned debriefings. We're required to do debriefings. And my view has always been we should be communicating more than we're required to, but we certainly should be encouraging communication from the beginning all the way through the end.
And right now, Dan, I have to communicate some more ads, so we do have to take a break. But when we come back, we'll be talking more with Dan Gordon. Dan is the Associate Dean for Government Procurement Law at George Washington University School of Law. And we'll talk a little bit about sequestration, what it means for contractors, potentially even government missions. We'll also talk a little bit about IDIQ contracts, one of my favorite subjects. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we are talking to Dan Gordon. Dan is the Associate Dean for Government Procurement Law at George Washington University School of Law. And Dan, now it's the topic of the day, the month, the fall, the new year, let's say, and that is sequestration. And there's a lot of talk about it being the fiscal cliff and all the bad things are going to happen. I'd like to get your thoughts on, first of all, what you think, how that impact will occur, I guess, timing-wise, and then just also what does it mean in the marketplace right now from your perspective?
It is certainly a major cause for concern. The fact is that Congress needs to do its job, needs to address this. The sequestration was put into the Budget Control Act, not so that it would happen, but so that it would be such a horrible thing to think about that it would force Congress to move forward and to work with the White House and to come up with what's often called a grand bargain. I continue to believe that we need to go down the path of the grand bargain. I think we're able to do it. The rough contours are already there. We almost got there last year. So that I am moderately hopeful that we will get there fairly soon. In terms of the sequestration itself, as I've been saying for a good number of months, unfortunately, the term fiscal cliff confuses people because they assume that on January 2nd of next year, there's going to be a freeze up of all contracts through sequestration and terminations for convenience of thousands of contracts.
Failure to exercise options, right, and things like that.
None of that's going to happen on January 2nd. The damage, in fact, has already started. And if Congress doesn't act promptly, the damage will get far worse as we move into late January and February, and then even worse as we go into March. But it's much more like a slope than a cliff. I think the damage is...
Hey, I have to ask you, though, what's the degree on that slope?
Way too steep.
Okay.
Way too steep.
Not a cliff, but a steep slope.
But a very steep slope that will get steeper over time. But I keep hearing about companies and agencies that are essentially slowing up or even freezing hiring now because of the uncertainty. And you can't blame them, whether it's private industry or the government. You'd rather not hire and suffer a little bit now than go through the pain and the disruption of a layoff or, for the government, a reduction in force. So the pain and the damage is happening right now and will get worse as we go into the new fiscal year.
Right. And I think, I just get your thoughts on this, because your comment, and it's all about, to me, uncertainty. And uncertainty, and I sometimes think, having worked in government for 20 years and then being on the other side, is that the government, you know, it has its processes and looks at the way things are, but, you know, lack of decisions create uncertainty. And the private sector reacts to that by it needs certainty in to be able to plan effectively, to be able to execute effectively. And I think the government loses sight of that, and no fault of it. I know it could be fault of the government, but I think there's a lack of understanding of that sometimes.
I couldn't agree more. The debt ceiling is a classic example. We knew we were going to have to raise the debt ceiling, but because of political grandstanding, we drove the country we were on the verge of driving the country into the ground. We got our credit rating reduced. It is political grandstanding that is damaging the country and creating that very uncertainty. We know what needs to be done. We're going to need to take some steps to increase tax revenue. We're going to need to take some painful steps to reduce spending. We can make it happen. I'm confident the country can make it happen. But this uncertainty now is doing an enormous amount of damage.
Well, you know, you talked about cuts or cost savings. I like to think of cost savings. Last week, I had Bill Gormley on the show. We did a whole show on areas where there's opportunities to save the money. And one of them we talked about was contract duplication and the fact that there's multiple agency-specific contracts, we call them enterprise contracts, that are for the same products and or services that are under pre-existing contracts, whether it's particular schedules program or GWACs or other MACs that have been put in place for the exact same thing, and how that increases costs to both government and industry. I'd like to get, you're the author of the business case memo, which we believe was a good first step in trying to address it. We advocate even stronger medicine, but I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
Absolutely, Roger. You may remember that I had some back and forth during one of my hearings, I think on the Senate side, about whether there are too many or too few interagency contracts. What I discovered, and I admit I changed my view on this once I learned the facts, what I discovered was that if anything, we have too few interagency contracts because we have enormous duplication where agency after agency after agency was doing an IDIQ contract for exactly the same goods and services. And if instead of having 30 single agency contracts, we ended up having 3 multi-agency contracts, we would have less duplication, not more.
Right. And to me, what that does too, though, and I get your thoughts on this, is I believe it ultimately reduces competition, because what happens is the market gets divided, right? In a case of, for example, the GSA schedules, if an agency goes and does a big IDIQ contract worth, you know, a couple $100 million of stuff that used to be bought, they used to buy off the schedules, you've reduced the market there that frankly forms the basis of negotiation for the GSA schedule contractors. Now, if I'm a schedule contractor, I'd say, well, you've reduced the market share that I have a potential to compete for. Oh, and you're asking me for a better price?
I understand, but you have a history that is known to your listeners and your readers in terms of the GSA federal supply schedule. It is worth pointing out that I think our system has benefited from some competition to the federal supply schedule. Again, I don't think we need 30 or 40 competing vehicles, but I think that the NIH contract, the GWAC there, I don't think has been harmful. I think it's been helpful. We looked long and hard when I worked at OMB before we approved NIH moving forward with a renewed, if you will, status as the executive agent for that contract. So I think some competition to GSA is a good thing. But what we don't need is this Wild West atmosphere where there's chaos. The chaos doesn't benefit the government, and it doesn't benefit the vendors.
Yeah, and I am talking about those 30 contracts. I mean, that's where the market gets divided. And you'll be happy to know that the Coalition for Government Procurement has a GWAC, MAC, and Enterprise Contracting Committee that we've formed. To frankly in support where appropriate those type of contract vehicles, the GWACs in particular. We've had Rob Cohen from NIH come and talk to us. We've had Joanne Wojtek from NASA SUP come and talk, and as well as the GSA GWAC folks. So we understand that, and I believe frankly that there's a right mix of those contracts. That competition is a good thing, but there's way too many individual agency contracts.
And that's why I think that the business case approach is the right one. The answer shouldn't be, no, we're going to give somebody a monopoly, whether it's GSA or anybody else. But the answer also shouldn't be anything goes. It's somewhere in between where you say, there, if you're talking about a large contract, large dollar volume, and it appears to duplicate an existing contract out there, you're going to need to make a business case and justify why the government will benefit more than it will lose from having that additional contract. That approach worked with GWACs, and I think it can work more broadly.
Dan, you know what you're talking about? I'm going to tell you what you're talking about. You're talking about, and it's one of the things that the coalition is going to be talking about over the next year, strategic acquisition. Hmm. There's strategic sourcing. But there's also, we've coined that term. I'll take ownership of it. Strategic acquisition, and it's looking at those contract duplication issues. How do we, organize the procurement system to get, obviously the best value for customer agencies, for the taxpayer, and sound business opportunities for the contractors. They go hand in hand. So, be watching for that. We'll be talking a lot about strategic acquisition.
I'll be watching.
Okay. Dan, right now we have to take our last break. So when we come back, we'll be talking more to Dan Gordon. He is the Associate Dean for Government Procurement Law at George Washington University School of Law. And we're going to talk a little bit more about strategic sourcing, his favorite subject. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf. Today, my guest is Dan Gordon. Dan is the Associate Dean for Government Procurement Law at George Washington University Law School. Okay. Steve Schooner out there, if you've been listening, I apologize. I was calling it School of Law. I could go to School of Rock. I don't know. It's one of my kids' favorite movies. But it is law school. So, Steve, I got it right. That's my fault. It's my bad. I will never do it again. But anyway, Dan, our last segment, we wanted to talk a little bit about strategic sourcing and whatever other issue comes up that we could talk about. But first, one of your major responsibilities while you were at OFPP and OMB was to focus on implementing strategic sourcing. And I just want to give you an opportunity to talk about your experiences there, what the challenges were, how you think it's going, and where do you think it goes from here, I think most importantly.
I'll tell you, I feel like we made some progress on strategic sourcing, but there's a lot more work that needs to be done. I know that my successor, Joe Jordan, is very focused on it, and that's a very good thing. Dan Tangerlini, the acting administrator at GSA, I think will also be very helpful. The basic fact is the government is the world's biggest buyer, but we don't buy smart enough. It's particularly galling when you watch the way all of us have changed the way we buy in our private lives dramatically over the last 15 years. It is so much easier today to get the best price, whether it's for an airline ticket or a book. We've got to be able to find a way to get the best price for the government when we're buying for the government. Strategic sourcing is one key way that we're trying to do it. We need to keep innovating. We need to keep using the internet so that we're buying smarter.
Well, I guess my first question, John, that is, how do you define the best price? Because that in the market, as you know, given the way people buy, you know, one day the best price is, you know, $50 for that airline ticket, and the next day it's $25. How, you know, that using that, I mean, because fundamentally, from my perspective, getting the best price, theoretically, there's always a better price at some point, depending on the circumstances.
One of the great things about the way GSA and OMB were leading the strategic sourcing effort when I was there, and I think this is continuing, is that they recognized that different markets were different. So that when they began to focus on a particular area, whether it was wireless devices or office supplies or printing capabilities, they put together a commodity team that focused on that industry and that market, which is the right way to go, because buying books is not like buying airline tickets. Buying office supplies is not like buying printers and copiers.
Okay. I'm interested in, I don't know how much the inside scoop you'll give us, but you know, what were your experiences like in as sort of OFP's leadership role and craft working with GSA and then the commodity councils? What did you learn from that, or what surprised you about that?
I was surprised at the level of interest from the buying agencies when they got used to the idea that this was a new GSA that was actually trying to work closely with them. A GSA, as you know well, Roger, has a long history. There have been a lot of scars along the way, and there are a lot of agencies who don't view GSA as getting them particularly good prices. There's sensitivity about the fees that GSA charges. I was happy to hear that Dan Tangerlini said in his Senate hearing a couple of weeks ago that they would be reducing their fees. I think that's a good thing. Agencies need to know that GSA is focused on providing good service, good prices, and good quality. And I can tell you that when I met with the team at GSA that was working, for example, in the office supply effort, when I met with the individual contracting officers leading that effort and the people at headquarters, I was very impressed that they were focused on serving the buying agencies. That's the way it should be.
Right. Okay. And where do you see strategic sourcing going down the road the next fiscal year or two? Do you have any thoughts on that?
We've got to save more money. The budget situation actually forces us to do what we should have been doing anyway. We need to find ways to spend less money, and that when we do buy things, to buy smarter. I heard a report recently that the initiative to reduce spending on management support services, the story I heard, I haven't checked the data yet, the story I heard is that, in fact, they're going to exceed the goal of reducing spending on management support services. And as long as it's done in a smart way, that's a good thing.
That, yeah, where it doesn't affect mission, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the things that we did in OMB, I remember, was we said, we don't want to cut spending on program evaluation services, because that can actually help agencies do their job better. But there's a lot of management support service spending that was unnecessary and was a luxury in any event. You just couldn't afford it. So when I've begun to hear that the government may actually exceed the goal of the spending reductions they mm-hmm. were trying to do, that would be terrific news. There's a lot more work to be done. You're never going to finish the job of saving money.
Well, you know, to that end, you know, I think what you've described in the folks at GSA, that the acquisition workforce and the people are, you know, of primary importance in getting, you know, in achieving these type of goals. So I wanted to give you, we've got just 2 or 3 minutes left that we can talk a little bit about the acquisition workforce. You know, you're still in that mode where you're training the next generation of lawyers who will be working in the acquisition workforce at the George Washington University Law School. Okay. Okay, Steve. Let's talk about the acquisition workforce a little bit. And first of all, just your impressions when you were there, what you saw in terms of, you know, the esprit de corps, that sort of thing.
There was nothing that I enjoyed more in the job than being out of the agencies, whether it was in Washington or in one of the states and cities across the country, meeting with the acquisition workforce. It was wonderful. Even when they growled at me, and they did sometimes growl at me and grouse at me, I still liked being there and listening and talking and learning from them. We really did succeed in increasing the size of the acquisition workforce. That's increasing the number of 1102s, contracting officers, contracting specialists. It's increasing the attention on and some of the training for contracting officers, representatives. It's starting to rebuild the cost and pricing analyst group. So we made progress. I'm very worried going forward. I'm very worried that the government's contracting needs aren't going to diminish all that much. And yet people in Washington, especially up on the Hill, are going to say, we need to save money. Let's slash the size of the agencies. That would be devastating. We've been down that road before. We know what happens when you don't have enough contract specialists and contracting officers. Bad things happen in your procurements. Later on, you have lots of fodder for IG reports and GAO reports and congressional hearings. But the way to avoid that isn't to pile on afterwards. The way to avoid that is to have enough people in the acquisition workforce and invest enough in them. We've been doing that for these past 3.5 years. I very much hope that we keep down that path.
Yeah. Well, given, you know, your concern in that area in terms of and the importance of investing in the workforce, do you have any thoughts on, are there opportunities to, quote, better leverage the workforce in terms of, you know, like, let's use, you know, my favorite example, GSA. You know, GSA's role, which I think is underappreciated, and it is, and GSA is under fire right now, but, you know, providing the contracting support for agencies, it seems to me what you're describing is an environment where that could be even more critical moving forward.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why I told the people on the Hill repeatedly that the problem isn't that we have too many interagency contracts, it's that we don't have enough. Because an interagency contract, whether it's led by GSA or NIH or NASA SOUP, those interagency contracts are reducing the workload of the individual agencies. We need to do that. And final word, I know we're going to have to break, but final word, we need to be using e-procurement way more. It leverages our workforce like nothing else.
Right. That's an investment moving forward could have huge potential for returns for the federal government. Absolutely. Yep. And Dan, it's great to have you on the show. Good to see you again.
It is my pleasure.
And glad you're enjoying your new life and new role. And I want to thank you again for being on the show. You've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. This is Roger Waldron. Have a great day.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30 only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.